Okay, so as I said, this tonight is a follow-on from their last talk. And it is about, as it says on the notice sheet, about the church and the purpose of the church. Last time we talked about much of what we, as a Bible-believing church, think of as Bible-believing Christianity. But in reality, it's a mixture of tradition, it's a mixture of culture, and it's a mixture of faith, and essentially, it's a mixture of us and all sorts of things mixed in together. And that's not wrong. It's not wrong to have our roots and our traditions, and in fact, it makes us what we are. But it becomes a problem when it constrains us and stops us moving forward. And we looked at four things, the truth about the church in the Bible. We looked at mission statements, the bride of Christ. That's what we're called to be. Not just us, Christian believers everywhere, in whatever form of local fellowship they are in, are going to be. Christ is returning for a radiant bride that will be united. We looked at the fact that Christ said to Peter, "You are the rock on which I will build my church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it." And we looked at a small verse in Timothy. The goal of this command is love, what the church is called to. Those are its mission statements, and there are others. I'm just summarising. We looked at what we are asked to be as a church, about love and unity. Jesus' prayer for the church, "Father, that they be one, even as I and you are one." What a calling. And we looked at other verses in the Bible about the need for us to be one, in one vision, one calling towards the glorious church. We looked at what the Bible said a bit about the church structure, about elders and deacons and responsible leadership, even about what, because the Bible is amazingly honest, isn't it? About what to do when things go wrong. Because they will on occasions. People will fall into sin. We're human, God knows that. So we looked at things like church discipline just briefly. But then we reflected that how little there is really in the Bible about what the church should be beyond a community of people. Because it is called to be a community of people. And I started off, you remember, by saying, when I mention the word church, what's the first thought? And the majority, including me, would immediately sort of think of a building or some description. But actually, it's a loving community of people. And we know that. But actually, the tradition makes us think of a building. And if we're not careful, that can creep into our thinking everywhere. I said that actually, a little bit of their own personal history was that, you know, Debbie and I came to faith around about 1978, just before we got married. And that was at the start of what became known as the Charismatic or the House Movement, and how radical that had been, and how it has transformed the church. Look at the worship tonight. Spirit-led. Thank you, Gail. Hearing the voice of God. Debbie and I were on the tail end of the hymn prayer sandwich. Anyone else remember the hymn prayer sandwich? Every Sunday, same routine. Come in, sing a hymn. A welcome and a prayer. Sing another hymn. Main prayer body. Led from the front. Then sing another hymn. Then the main bit of the service. The word. You'll be very glad to know the main bit of the service isn't the word tonight. It's communion with God. And then another hymn. And then go home. Same format every week. Or if you were from another tradition, it might be slightly different. But that was the principle. And we thought about how times have changed over 30 years. Ian was very honest when he was talking about the Ealing movement. It's Ealing's 100 years anniversary this year. And that's all about looking forward. But how Ealing started 100 years ago, and for the first 30 years it was spirit-led and dynamic. How it settled. And then how it was challenged by God pouring out his spirit in the 1980s. A whole new generation. And actually talked about how not all of that was godly. There was a lot of arrogant young men, including this one, that sort of took hold of things that God was saying. And I think sometimes we made it, well, we did discredit, because we're foolish, because we're sinful. But God works with us. God builds his church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. So tonight, I want to sort of carry on from that, really. And I want to share with you two prophetic sermons from that time, really. I'm going to summarise them, please, now, especially as one took a week to preach. And sort of say that I think God has partly fulfilled that vision, but we've got a long way to go. And as we come to rising in faith for our own building, and the dynamic of that building, what Ian shared about it being a multi-function centre, how we need to be stepping up in faith and within our understanding of the church. We're not going to get everything right, because we didn't get everything right 30 years ago. So when we look forward, but I'm going to try to draw some of the things out in those prophetic sermons. Now, the first one, we think about, you see, the sort of charismatic movement starting up in the 1980s, but of course in reality, it started about 10 years previously in the Bible colleges, where God was moving and equipping people. And one of the main people that was quite instrumental in that was an American called Ernest Baxter. And I know that he had quite an influence. And one of the key sermons that he preached, which I just touched on last time, and I said the church needs to be a spirit-led church, and that God will build the church to be a spirit-led church, not a man-made church, was the story of Saul and David. Now, to summarise two sermons very quickly, I'm going to focus mainly on this bit about Saul, because I guess we mainly know David's story. That being said, I would encourage you, sometimes I think, and certainly preparing this, I was challenged, sometimes just to read the Old Testament stories, rather than always just studying or looking at little bits of the Bible. Read a story, almost like a novel. You are reading truth, you're reading history, you're reading about how God deals with people. And it's a lovely read as well. Right, so, up until Saul became the king, the people of Israel didn't have a king. God appointed judges and leaders because God was their king. The last one was Samuel. But Samuel's sons rebelled and didn't follow the way of God. And the people rose up and said, "We want a king. We want to be like all the other nations." And Samuel wrestled with God. And in 1 Samuel 8, verse 4, it says, "So the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel, and they said to him, 'You are old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint a king to lead us, such as all the other nations have.' But when they said, 'Give us a king to lead us,' this displeased Samuel. So he prayed to the Lord, and the Lord told him, 'Listen to all that the people are saying to you. It's not you they have rejected, but they're rejecting me as their king. And as they have done from the day I brought them up out of Egypt until this day, forsaking me and serving other gods, so they're doing to you. Now listen to them, but warn them solemnly and let them know what the king who reign over them will do.'" And the story goes on to talk about the king serving himself. Solemn warning there. How often do we, when God needs to discipline us, the way that God disciplines us mostly is to say, "Okay, go your own way." Solemn word. Anyway, God says, "Okay, you can have a king." And he identifies Saul to be their king. So in 1 Samuel 9, it says, "There was a Benjaminite, a man standing whose name was Kish, son of Abel, the son of Zerah, the son of Barakotta, the son of Ephraim, and of Benjamin. He had a son named Saul, an impressive young man, without equal among the Israelites, a head taller than any others." This was the guy that looked like the king. This was the guy who was going to achieve popular support. So Samuel goes to Saul and anoints him and tells him that he's going to be made king over Israel. and in 1 Samuel 9 verse 21, Saul answered, "But am I not a Benjamite from the smallest tribe of Israel? And is my clan the least of all the clans of the tribe of Benjamin? Why do you say such a thing to me?" It appears that Saul is very humble at this point. Samuel then took a flask, I'm jumping a bit, Samuel took a flask of oil, poured it on Saul's head and kissed him, saying, "Has not the Lord anointed you leader over his inheritance?" Now, jump forward a bit, he's just been anointed leader of Israel. When Samuel walked, and then the next thing happens is Samuel brings the tribe of Israel near. The tribe of Benjamin was chosen. He brought forward the tribe of Benjamin, clan by clan. And eventually we get down to Saul. Except Saul isn't there. So they inquired further, "Lord, has the man come here yet?" And the Lord said to him, "Yes, he's hidden himself among the baggage. In the baggage car, this man anointed me by God to be the leader of Israel. The head and shoulders man, hiding in the baggage car." God, sometimes, you know, we might see that as humility for serving God. But God's told you to do something. Don't hide in the baggage car. Have courage, have faith, have authority, because God's given it to you. You are sons and daughters of the living God. Do what you were commissioned to do. That is a challenge from God. Things don't go well for Saul, do they? And it came to the point where Saul was at Gilgal, and they were facing the Philistines, and he had very clear instructions to wait 7 days, and Samuel would come and anoint them. So Saul is king, he's waiting at Gilgal with his troops, and his troops are quaking in fear. He waited for 7 days, the time set by Samuel, but Samuel did not come to Gilgal, and Saul's men began to scatter. So he said, "Bring me the burnt offerings and the fellowship offerings." And Saul offered up the burnt offering. Saul did, not Samuel. It was the prophet's job to do it, not the king's. Just as he finished making the offering, Samuel arrived, and Saul went out to greet him. "What have you done?" asked Samuel. Saul replied, "When I saw the men were scattering and you did not come at the set time, and the Philistines were assembling at Mishmash, I thought, now the Philistines will come down against me at Gilgal, and I have not sought the Lord's favour, so I felt compelled to offer a burnt offering." He had been told not to do it. That wasn't the king's role. So, Samuel said, "You acted foolishly. You have not kept the command the Lord your God gave you. If you had, he would have established your kingdom over Israel for all time. But now your kingdom will not endure. The Lord has sought out a man after his own heart." We now know that man to be David. "And appointed him leader over his people, because you have not kept the Lord's command." However, when this happened, Saul was 30 years old when he became king, and this happened quite quickly after, so maybe 31, 32. He reigned over Israel for 42 years. God doesn't always do what he says immediately. Saul had been told that his kingdom would be taken from him. He continued to reign for another 42 years. Sometimes we lose sight of what God's doing, because God thinks in decades where we think of weeks. You know the story. The story goes on to how David became king. You all know that David wasn't perfect. He made many mistakes, murder and adultery amongst them. But, as it says here, the Bible describes David as a man after God's own heart. And we said that that fundamentally is the mark of a spirit-filled church. It's a church that seeks out, "Lord, what are you doing? What are you saying to us? What are we doing?" I fully believe in the gifts of the Spirit. You know that. I love to see prophecy. Love to see the worship tonight. But fundamentally, and we know there are brothers and sisters around who have a heart after God, who wouldn't necessarily feel comfortable leading that way. Yet, God may well be at that point, I think God will. But that is not the mark of a Spirit-filled church. I think it's one of the mistakes we made in the 80s. Which we said, this is what the church will look like. And if you don't agree with us, then you're not in. Actually, God is a loving Heavenly Father who takes his children to the place that he wants them to be, and he's patient. He builds his church. The gates of hell will not prevail against it. Right. What Ern Baxter was saying using this story, contrasting Saul to David, is that, going back to the 1980s, the majority of the church was, if you like, the Head and Shoulders Church. The church made by man, the church bound in tradition. We know there's glorious exceptions, but it's the way we did things. There wasn't much room for change. And actually, it was becoming increasingly less effective. 50% of young people, it is said, in the 1950s, went to some form of youth group or was associated in some way or other with an evangelical leaning church, a church that preached the gospel. By the time Debbie and I were young Christians, the prevailing view amongst young people was that we didn't have a problem with the claims of the gospel, we didn't have a problem with God. But why do we have to go to church? If we think about what has happened since then, I've already said about the worship, the songs, the expressions to God, home group, the different ways we express church, the sense of community. Church is transformed. And not just the charismatic church, it is spreading to all. Because I honestly believe the Spirit-filled church is rising up. That is what God said. The man-made church is dying, and there are still some that probably are going to need to die. That is not a threat. That is not something to be seen as being negative. Because God's Spirit is on the move. Then the other sermon relates to the story of Joseph. Remember the story of Joseph? For sake of time, I'll just paraphrase it. Joseph was the youngest and the most loved of his father. He wasn't that clever, if we're honest, because he wasn't particularly liked because he was the most loved. He was the favourite son. However, not only that, but then he had dreams given to him by God, but shared insensitively to his brothers, where he said, "You all bow down and worship me." The story goes on, doesn't it? But his brother's hatred grew so great that they threw him into a pit and left him to die. He was rescued and ended up in Egypt. Life wasn't great for him in Egypt. Even after he interpreted Pharaoh's dreams and became elevated to be a counsellor in Pharaoh's palace, his wife wanted an adulterous relationship with him, and when he godly refused, she accused him of it and ended up back in prison. The famine hit. Joseph's father sent Joseph's brothers down into Egypt for food, because Joseph, under God's guidance, had prepared for the famine, and Egypt had plenty of food. when Joseph revealed himself to his brothers, as the story progressed, his brothers were in fear and trembling. Joseph said, "You meant it for evil, but God meant it for good." Now, at that time, in the 1980s, a lot of church splits, a lot of people being thrown out, and I'm not saying it was all one-sided. I'm not saying it was all good. But there was a sense in which brothers and sisters who do not understand what was happening would come back and come to a point where they would understand. Now, I think many of those that were in that movement at that time misunderstood that, as I hinted earlier, we all thought that it would be coming to church like us. We now know the glorious benefit of history is not like that. But we do see Christians working together. We do see massive moves that have happened which enable the gospel to be preached. Think about that as just one example. Worldwide phenomenon. So, let's move forward a bit moving out. Sorry about this. This is where we get between me and the professionals. So, where has God brought us? I shared before that as we move in faith toward our own building, I think those prophecies, that move of the Spirit, which is the way forward. God, the church, it's God's plan A for this country. And there is no plan B. We've come so far, but is there a risk we've settled? That's what tends to happen whenever you look at any church movement. So the challenge tonight is let's not be settled. And as we move forward, let's be open to the voice of God. Now, at this point, as I sort of wrap this up with this challenge, we need to be open to the voice of God as we move forward. How is God going to give us this building? How is God going to build and expand this church? We don't know, do we? We're moving forward in faith. But we know we have a God of miracles. We know we have a God who can do anything. And we know, as Debbie thought earlier, and this, oh, that's a husband, it's not a husband and wife double act, okay? I did not know she was going to say this. We don't have, because we don't ask. And Ian encouraged us, when he's talking about the building and laying that out, to ask, to step out in faith. But what is God also doing? He's building Christian communities. We need to open our boundaries, borders up, because brothers and sisters are looking at us, we're growing together. And I do believe, and that's one of the big moves that's happened, as the charismatic movement, if you want to call it that, has spread out and affected church after church after church, in different ways, from different denominational backgrounds, no church has yet arrived, we're all on a journey, but we need not to settle. We need to be open to where God is calling us to be, the bride of Christ, the united local bride of Christ. Yes, within safe eldership and safe leadership, but working together. It might be, and you've already shared some of this, that with our new building, there are even closer links across. We might need help from others to get it. Who knows? But we need to be careful that what God started, we don't lose for generations because we haven't moved in faith. And there's many examples throughout biblical history, the most famous one being Moses walking around in the desert for 40 years, where God passes a generation. Let not that be said about us. So, bit of speculation, and this bit I do not claim prophetic knowledge for, it's just purely speculation. It does seem to me that God is calling the church to closer unity. It does seem to me that God is calling the church to more local expression rather than denominational expression of Christianity. As we're moving toward our own building, it's just useful to reflect. My son Tom in London, they've got their own building. They outgrew it. So now they're meeting in the local high school. There are two other churches meeting at local high school every Sunday. What does that say to the community? There's a lot going on. On the other hand, my other son in Southampton, he goes to Life Church. Southampton Baptist Central Church. Lovely building, a bit like Trinity. Very prominent place, but actually, because it had struggled and struggled for years, when you look at the outside of it, it says decay, closed. They've gone into partnership. They've brought life back into that building. Local church, local solutions. What God has for us will not be the same as what God has for a church, never mind Southampton, Holmfirth or Huddersfield. We need to pray and to find our own way. But also, I think, God will call the church to be more radical, to have more of a voice on national issues, to think more about being involved in not only the local community, but national community. I don't know how God's going to do that. But I just want to finish with one quote or story that I heard of years ago. A young lady who went to the London church was stopped by some guys in London wanting her to buy a copy of The Socialist Worker. And she looked at him and turned around and engaged him in conversation a bit. She said, nah, it's not radical enough. You know, these are the activists. It's not... What radicalism are you looking for then? And she said, the radicalism I can give you, Christianity, is far more radical because it changes people's hearts from the inside. And they said, and they challenged her and said, but we don't see it when we look at Christians. I think God will call us to a point where that will not be said. People will see it. And I think over the next 10 years or so, the church is entering a very, very exciting time. Because I think we've only partly seen the fulfilment of the vision that was given in the 1980s.